Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, AWM Program Director Allison Sansoni chats with editor Jennifer Minton Quigley about her recent anthology, Lolita in the Afterlife, on beauty, risk, and reckoning with the most indelible and shocking novel of the 20th century. They are joined by contributing writers Bindu Basanath, Alexander Heeman, and Laurie Lipman. This conversation originally took place March 31st, 2021, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
We're grateful to everyone for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. In her introduction to Lolita in the Afterlife, Jenny Minton Quigley describes the initial reception to her father's publication of the novel. The New York Times called it repulsive, highbrow pornography, which, she writes, was music to my father's ears. America has been reckoning with the best-selling iconic novel ever since, and in her book, Jenny gathers more than 24 renowned writers to assess its legacy in social, political, literary, and personal ways. We're here tonight with three of them, crime novelist Laura Lipman, whose essay examines the novel as detective story, Bindu Basanath, who knew in Lolita compassion for a past self, and Alexander Heeman, who writes about immigrants and refugees like Nabokov finding their home in language. Jenny Minton Quigley is here with us as well. She's the series editor for the Best Short Stories of the Year, the O. Henry Prize winners, and the author of a memoir, The Early Birds. She is the daughter of Walter J. Minton, the storied former president and publisher of G.P. Putnam's Sons, who first dared to publish Lolita in the United States in 1958. Welcome to you all. I wanted to start us off tonight by asking each of you to talk about something that you all touched on in your essays, and that is sort of the where were you when moment, the way in which you first read Lolita.
Do you want to designate an order as how we should talk, or?
I feel like since you were the youngest, Laura, you should go first.
Oh, the youngest when I found it. It's such a weird story. And it's because I had very odd reading habits. So here I am, I'm 11 or 12 years old, and I'm reading the humor columns of Jean Kerr, who is best known, Please Don't Eat the Daisies. She was married to the New York Times theater critic Walter Kerr, who I now believe has a theater named after him on Broadway. And she did this funny mashup about what it was like to read the novel Lolita and a column, Can This Marriage Be Saved, in the same day? And she imagined what it would be like if Humbert and Lolita were the two characters in this, I think it was a Red Book magazine feature. And I was a kid who was very much on the hunt for dirty stuff. I just wanted to read pornography, probably. But I was just really fascinated by anything that was salacious. And I was like, I could tell that Lolita was on some level a forbidden book. So I started trying to read it when I was age 12, which was ridiculous. I didn't understand any of it. I was certainly disappointed as someone who was looking for incredibly explicit passages. But I kept rereading it. And so by the time I get to college, I've probably already read Lolita 3 or 4 times. And in college, I read it again. I read it in a survey class taught by Alfred Appel. And I've kept reading it pretty much, I say I read it every other year still. And I always find something new in it.
Bindu, would you like to go next?
I'll go next. I also was like maybe 11, I was 12 or 13 when I first came across it. And it's hard for me to remember exactly, I don't know how I heard about the book, but when I kind of heard about it and heard about the content, and I was in this position at that point in my life where I was in fact like being groomed, and maybe I was starting to, you know, come to some kind of reckoning with that. And I was looking for stories that mirrored mine without actually telling that story to anyone. So I remember, and I misspoke, I said I was 12, I was actually 15. I don't know. But so I remember going to like a Barnes and Noble with my dad, and I would go to that section, and it was always one of the ones that were on display. It was a cover with half of a girl's lips. And I just said, like, I wanted this book, and he never usually questioned my book choices before. And then the fact that even he felt like, this is like, why do you want this? And after that, I knew that I had to read it. And in fact, the man who was grooming me gave it to me as a gift. And I read it then. And then I didn't reread it until I was in college and I was in a seminar called Narrating Rape. So it was a very, very different lens. And, you know, I was on the other side of that. So yeah, that's how I came, how I came to read it.
Well, I was much older, as I'm probably now, than all of you. I was in my mid-20s when I found Lolita on the shelf of a library. And I still remember the layout of that library room where I found Lolita in translation. I grew up in Sarajevo, Bosnia and Herzegovina. And I had heard of Nabokov and Lolita. And then I picked up the book and it was, I had never had read anything like that. And it wasn't so much the pedophilia of it, but the language, the exuberance of the language, the metaphors, the constant presence of a linguistic force in the book, right? We're not Humbert, but Nabokov. And so then I found myself in the United States, in Chicago, in the early 90s, as the war in Bosnia was unfolding, and found Lolita again, because I had decided that I would have to write in English as opposed to my native language, Bosnian, and that the way to acquire the writing language was to read a lot. And so then I started with the books I liked. And one of them, obviously, one of the first ones was Lolita. And so that I started reading Lolita in English, but my knowledge was inadequate to understand that. And so my plan was to learn the language enough to write in it by way of reading. And so I started underlining the words in Lolita that I didn't know. But the first few pages got so thick with underlines that I had to start writing words on note cards. And then I would look them up in the dictionary. It was called a dictionary for an advanced learner, Oxford Dictionary for an Advanced Learner. And so I would look up those words, and many of them were not in that advanced learner's dictionary. And so I kept reading Lolita and looking up the words, and over again, a couple of times, the first time in English. And I was also, my first legal job, I had the legal jobs before that, was canvassing for Greenpeace. And so that I would use some of the Nabokovian words at the door, canvassing door to door, and mispronouncing them, as, you know, like children who learn words from books. I didn't know how to say. I would pronounce akin as Aiken. And, you know, I learned thwart from Nabokov and hirsute and all that. And so I would deploy these words at the door in Chicago suburbs. And, you know, I was from Mars as far as those people were concerned. And so much of the first batch of English words that I would deploy in my writing after I started writing in English came from Nabokov and Lolita.
Jenny, your story obviously is a little more of a personal one.
No, I loved that image of you going, you know, canvassing for Greenpeace and throwing out all these Nabokov terms. People just staring at you. But my story is not as exciting. I was in college freshman year English course. And I think I was 18 years old, and this was now years ago, and I aged up Lolita as I was reading it. I remember thinking it was romantic. I remember thinking Lolita was like me, and it wasn't until, and I, you know, flew through it and also had to look up words then, and recently reread it and still had to look up words. But when I reread it, this time, I just couldn't get over that she was 12. Like, how had I aged her up, and why? You know, Susan Choi in her piece says that Humbert rarely describes Lolita as a child. And that might have been one of the reasons. I read it differently as a mother, that's for sure.
Reading the book, one of the things that really impressed me was the way in which the writers engaged with the work itself. When the volume of commentary over something gets to the point that it has with Lolita, where you feel that you've read so much about it that even if you haven't read it, you feel like you think you know what it is. Did you all have other critical analyses in mind as you wrote your own? Were you responding to things, or were you directly just assessing the text on its own terms?
Well, I'll jump in and I'll say both. I think the thing that was really on my mind as I was writing is that I have friends who say that the book should not be read anymore. And they're just flat out, I mean, are we going to have to invoke the term cancel culture? Because I've certainly heard people say that Lolita, because of its subject matter, is not something that's worthy of our attention. I write crime novels. I have a hard time with the idea of what are worthy subjects. But I did feel in being asked to work on this book that it was a chance to work out for myself what I would say to those friends. It felt very personal to me. So I guess I wasn't really responding to critical analysis, but to a kind of public censure of people who were like, why would you read that book? What does it have for us? And there was one particular friend whose voice was in my head. And of course, I'm not saying that anyone has to read it, obviously, no. And I know people who would, in fact, find the subject matter difficult and painful. That's an individual choice. I mean, they know enough to make the choice. I don't think anyone wanders into Lolita not knowing what they're in for. I was also really disappointed in smart writers who said, to write this book, one has to be a pedophile. I just found that to be so simplistic and narrow and, as I said, disappointing. So those were the things I had in mind.
Well, I know that my essay actually started off, I mentioned that narrating rape class, and my essay started off as my midterm paper for that class. And our professor said you could kind of introduce a creative element into your, you know, standard essay or do some kind of multimedia project. And I knew I wanted to write about this book. And I know there was some critical papers as well, but to be honest, I don't remember which ones they were after this whole process of paring it down to a personal essay. But whatever it was, just being able to write that academic paper. And I told her I wanted to weave in a personal element to it because for me, they were so linked. And I did that. And then it kind of just gave me the freedom to write down the story that I don't think I would have been able to do if it was just, you know, me approaching it as a personal essay. The fact that I wasn't, I knew it would be looked at from a different lens kind of gave me that freedom to do. So I never imagined that I would take all those bits out and then really have to like confront that personal narrative piece that was only supposed to be like a little thread in that.
For whatever reason, I to me, the stuff of literature is language, right? The representation is secondary to it, right? In other words, representation is an excuse to use language. And that's what I thought and think to a large extent even now. And so to me, it was always self-evident that Humbert Humbert was a monster, that it was a crime, and that there was the history of literature, there are all these books in which the narrators or the characters are just monsters. I busied myself when I was younger, I don't think I could do it now, with reading Marquis de Sade, 120 Days of Sodom, right? And compared to that, Lolita is a walk in the park. And so it is also that once I got to the United States, and enter the situation of displacement, which is perpetual, that I read all of Nabokov and other writers, many other writers, from the angle of displacement, right? And so that I believed and believe still that the primary theme in just about all of Nabokov's work is displacement. And that a pedophile like Humbert Humbert is an excuse to address that topic. Now, having said this, right, what I've learned after rereading Lolita and even teaching it more than once, right, is that it is an indulgent angle to the extent that I have never been subject to the violence of patriarchy in the way that women or girls of 12-year-old girls might have been, right? And so, in fact, I probably benefited, and I did benefit, not probably, from being a man in patriarchy. And so I cannot dismiss, I would never dismiss that reading at all of Humbert and Lolita by extension, reproducing the hierarchies of patriarchy, of sexualizing 12-year-old girls. My daughters are now 9 and 13, and I'm the thick of it in many ways. I would also say that that for whatever reason in my life in the United States, the past 30 years, but it's, I think it's picked up in some ways in the past 10 or 15 or 20 years. For whatever reason, the dominant mode of reading books of fiction is empathy. And it has a moral angle. That is, you read a book to empathize with characters, but you empathize with those who are, who could benefit from empathy, with victims, right? And this can really easily result in just the worst kind of Uncle Tom or A Little Life sentimentality, where the characters are tortured so that we could feel empathy. And so my approach as a writer and as a reader is to seek a somewhat different approach, and that would be, in psychological terms, described as theory of mind, as a psychological concept, where you understand how other minds work without identifying them. Empathy, affective identification, and pornography depends on empathy. That is, you watch people having sex and then you feel arousal if you do, right? Whereas the theory of the mind is our basic human ability, typically developed humans, to understand that someone else who is not me would have a mind and emotions and beliefs and life history and fetishes that are entirely different from mine. And so to be able to inhabit that mind in a book, right, I think is essential to literature. It is different from empathizing, that is, it's different from being aroused by Humbert being aroused by Lolita, right? It is obvious that that cannot be entirely controlled, right? That people have been aroused by Lolita in Humbert's rendition, right? And I cannot quite get around that, really. I cannot say you should not read the book, but I also cannot say you should read the book, because people come from their own life histories and experiences, and things mean different things to them. I mean, I think we're likely to agree that the book should not be banned or not read, but it should be talked about. And the book that Jenny put together is an occasion for that.
Oh, I have so many things to say here. Okay, so the first thing that I just wanted to share is what Sasha actually said about that feeling of displacement so beautifully. He said, "What Lolita showed me is not how to wrangle the beast of the English tongue, but that it is possible to transform it enough to compensate for ceaselessly feeling that wherever I may be, I am never at home." And I just think that's so beautiful. I had never thought of Lolita that way, but of course Nabokov was a refugee as well. It transitions me into Laura's piece, because talking about this book now, Laura, who had studied with, when I asked you to write about mystery, the mystery of Lolita, I had no idea you had studied with that you had studied with Alfred Appel, whose annotated version of Lolita is still the only one. I mean, that's a huge question. So Laura talks about exactly what you're saying, Sasha, that why these words. I'd love to have you tell everyone, you know, the transcendence and redemption and the words that Appel points to for how we understand this book. Laura questions whether those are the right clues to reading it today.
I think it's a tricky question. I don't think people bring their own experience into books. That's part of the reading experience. And it's difficult to suspend it. I do it too, right? But I was not raped or assaulted by anyone. I was groped by a man once or twice when I was a kid, but that it's nowhere near the experience of being a woman in patriarchy. And so I cannot dismiss this as, you know, and there was recently a Washington Post reporter was not suspended, but she was taken to be biased when writing about issues of sexual assault and abuse, because she was once sexually assaulted and abused, right? And that's ridiculous. Of course, men were also have a bias in and of themselves by virtue of being men in patriarchy. So I cannot dismiss this, but I also cannot abandon the language of Lolita. I don't think it can transcend the crimes of patriarchy, right? And one of which Humbert describes as a glorious language, the fireworks of rhetoric. But I cannot find it in myself to abandon that language. I love it. To me, that picnic lightning parenthesis when he describes his mother's death, every time I read that, I want to weep. I want to write that sentence. And so I've been conceiving of a sentence writing course, and this is the sentence that I would teach first. I have, in an isolated way, because something happens in language.
I think when it comes to the issue of redemption, I can understand the impulse for some readers, who want to believe that there is redemption for Humbert. But I think that tells us more about the reader than about the book that's in front of us. And I think common sense tells us that Humbert is beyond redemption. I mean, if we just look at it in a very cold, clinical way, he suffers from a compulsive disorder that is almost impossible to cure or stop. It's just that's just what we know. And so when I kept coming back to this idea that somehow Humbert is redeemed by the end of the book, I just don't buy it. And I feel that those who argued that point, and Appel was one, that was a reading he needed. I mean, this book can be a very interesting little psychological test for each reader. What do you see? What are you drawn to? What matters to you? How do you wish to experience it? And I think the early readers, you know, sort of the first readers of Lolita, some of them really had a hard time with the fact that this is a bad person who's done a bad thing and has now spent all these beautiful words rationalizing and explaining, never apologizing, never saying he was in the wrong. And it's fascinating. I mean, I love this book. And I guess I'm always arguing for, you can love the book, you don't have to love Humbert. The book does not require that of you. If anything is asking, I think the smart readers are happy to inspect under the layers of those beautiful, beautiful words, what he's doing and what he's covering up.
There's a line from your essay that I kept thinking of as we're talking here about who the story belongs to. And I was curious to hear, you know, who does this book belong to now? Who is it for?
I don't know that I have an answer to that question. I think it's for anyone who happens upon it and wants to, you know, take it on. I know that as I grew older, I was reading it for her. I was kind of trying to find, and you never can really find her because she's always filtered through everything he says about her. But I'd like to think, I think the more I read it, I was like, where are the pieces where, you know, it's when she says something in quotes and like that has to be objectively what she said at that moment, right? Or the chapter, and I forget, it's somewhere in the 30s, it's like 31 through 34, it could be any of those, but where he talks about, you know, the fact that she was crying when her mother died, or when she saw another student at her prep school have this like tender interaction with her father. And it's like he's clocked all of her grief this whole time. And it just feels like, you know, those moments I read for those, you know, because I feel like I can see her. But then also, that's not true. I can't. It's still his story. So,
well, I think, I mean, I agree with Laura that the redemption is not available. What's undone cannot be undone. But I'm also wary of the demand that put upon literature and books to provide some kind of moral capital, right? That you read it and become a better person. And I think that it's rooted in Christianity in this country in particular, right? That you for a book to be legitimate, it has to improve you as a person and measurably, right? You have to learn what the sins are and understand what's punishable as sins. And to me, that is just reductive. And it leads to this sort of crypto-Christian kind of literature, that empathetic empathy porn, that you know, someone has to be tortured as a victim so that you feel empathy for them, so that you can feel that you are properly empathetic and therefore by implication, or maybe just straight out, Christian, right? And this, to me, it is fundamentally ideological. And so it is very difficult to conceive of a book as a polemic, right? If you approach it from the empathetic angle, right? So Lolita is about a pedophile on the surface, but it's also about the power of language, right? To what extent language can conceal crimes. And you read the front page of goddamn New York Times that you can see how it works, right? Every day. And you can see that the rhetoric of powerful men and powerful people, and see how language conceals criminality and immorality. And so what Lolita does is expose this. It is essential to the project that Humbert is such a master of language. Of course, it's Nabokov behind it. But it's this negotiation. Do we stay dazzled with his words and see and not see the crime, or do we see the crime? And so these moments when he mentions her tears and her suffering, these are heartbreaking, right? Because no one failed to notice that, I believe, as a reader in various ways. They might give a different value to it, but it's not invisible in any way.
No, I absolutely agree. And one of the things I examined in the essay was that if you stop to think about it, we all know the famous passage about her cries every night. But I started to think about how many people turned a blind eye to Dolores Hayes. How many people didn't see the police officer who pulls over the car, a neighbor who he tells, oh, it's just a loud party. The one that just upset me so much on this reading is the doctor who examines his feverish daughter, and he congratulates the doctor on her incuriosity and then goes on to note the specific pleasure of having sex with someone with the flu. It's just like, I mean, and this is true of a lot of crimes against children, is that there are so many sort of co-conspirators by omission, people who are being so polite and turning away because we don't look too closely at our neighbors. That's not our business. And that was an aspect of the book that was really new to me on the reading I did for this essay. I had never really thought about how many people had the information and chose not to see it. I mean, one of the things that's interesting is that tradition in life, women who are married to someone like Humbert do not act as decisively as Charlotte Hayes did. They do not immediately say, "You'll never get near my kid again. You're a monster." They tend to be very caught up, like, "Oh, well, I'm sure it's not what I think it is," and they can be won over. And so, this was also a reading which I was like, you know, Charlotte was actually really trying to do the right thing the moment she knew what was going on. And so this redemption thing, it's still, and also in the genre I work in, there's so much discussion of whether characters are likable, which is so odd to me that I have no interest in, I don't care about reading about likable people, and I don't care about writing about them. And so I'm always, you know, being asked like, "Well, don't you find that these characters that you've written are unlikable?" I'm like, yes. They're not there to be your friend. I'm trying to do something different. And I think also one thing that interests me in Lolita is that Nabokov knows the crime novel so well. He knows so many aspects of it. And he's sort of poking fun at it because Humbert's so horrible as a detective and he can't find Lolita. And I think that he is someone who, he's definitely rejecting the idea. There's a weird thing about the crime novel that I wrestle with all the time. It's a really conservative form. The crime novel puts forward the idea that society is okay, a crime happens, and if we solve it, society goes back to being okay. And however you read Lolita, you cannot read it as a book that puts forward the idea that everything's okay. And when we know all the who, what, where, when, and how, and why, and someone's behind bars, that society will go back to being okay. So that to me is also one of its great strengths.
I thought too, you know, Laura, you pointed out that had Charlotte not been offed by Humbert, right? Had she not been done away with, she would have protected Lolita and Bindu. I love the line that you write. He knew that to groom girls, you must erase mothers.
Yeah.
Right? I'd love for you to speak on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you see it with like the relationship that he has with Charlotte when she's still alive, where in a way he's like grooming her too. Like he's grooming her to turn a blind eye to, I don't know, the things that go on in the house. And then ultimately, like as soon as she finds his journal and is going to like take Lolita away from him and protect her daughter, then she must be eliminated because she can no longer be groomed by him. And it's the only way, you know, to erase that female presence from her life. Like, it's just an essential and tragic step in his whole process.
When we look at the distinction between, you know, we're talking a lot about the importance of the book. When we look at the distinction between something that's transgressive and equally important as opposed to shocking for the sake of being shocking. Where is that line in Lolita where between here, look at this and pay attention and something deeper going on underneath the surface?
When I had taught Lolita more than once, and it was, as you might imagine, it was a difficult book to teach. And so what I had to get across to get anywhere is that the empathetic identification thing would not work, because if you empathize with Humbert, you are a pedophile. And so, and then the challenge is to inhabit the mind of a pedophile. And that means the kind of a doubling of the mind. That is, you understand how a pedophile thinks without approving it. And you also understand, you have your own mind, presumably, you know, not endorsing pedophilia. And so to combine those two opens up a space in which ideally, and of course, there have to have been people who were roused again by Humbert and Lolita's presentation or representation in the book. But I would venture to think that no, Lolita never turned someone into a pedophile. They were already pedophiles. Right, they used it as a prop if they did. And so ideally, and it's obviously not guaranteed, the way Lolita works is to expose the ways in which patriarchy and its extreme and pedophilia works, right? The objectification of a child, a female child, right? And the pop culture that endorses. This is 1958. I have daughters who are 9 and 13. I cannot begin to describe the videos that they're watching right now. And they're not, you know, they're legit. Everyone's watching. And so to see how this thing, the whole thing operates, you could inhabit the mind of a pedophile and see what that world looks to a pedophile, right? And it exposes faults and the horror of it. And what Laura was saying, right? You can think, the world is okay once we solve the crime, right? Or the world is inherently screwed up because it is organized by way of patriarchy. I mean, and certainly in Lolita, and to this day, right? We may have made some advances, but nowhere near enough.
But years ago, so I think we're talking early 90s, was when a young woman in her teens, but later teens, attempted to shoot the wife of a man with whom she was having an affair, Amy Fisher. And she was instantly referred to in the New York tabloids as Long Island Lolita. She was a late teen. She had been in, I'm not going to call it a consensual relationship, but a relationship that was certainly different than a relationship someone would have with a 12-year-old. And that always bothered me so much. I tried to write about it at the time, and I found that at the newspaper where I worked, they didn't even understand what I was talking about. which was this constant desire to sexualize Lolita, whether it's Sue Lyon in the original film, or this idea of using the word where people don't even, obviously don't even know what they're talking about. I mean, it's funny, I have a 10-year-old, you know, I have a 10-year-old and she's still playing with dolls and playing make-believe games. And to think of, you know, someone sexualizing my daughter is, you know, enough to make me, you know, quite blind with rage. And I think this is, you know, part of the problem for people with Lolita is that they don't want to think about what it's really about. They don't want to remember that she's a child. And in that we have a very willing co-conspirator, which is Humbert. Humbert doesn't want us to remember that she's a child, not really. And, you know, there's this constant, lying, this presentation of her as being someone who is already sexually experienced, and it's her idea for them to have sex. And all of that is, you know, something I come back to again and again in the book. And I also think it's something that people struggle with in trying to come to terms with the book.
I think the reason it's helpful to have these conversations and to have a book about it too, is that Lolita's still selling. So it's being taught in classes, which is terrific, but it's also, it's still being read, you know, and there's on book talks, there are TikToks, but young women read passages of Lolita. And there's Kate Elizabeth Russell has a piece in the book about the internet chat that she was in that was all fans of Lolita, but there was grooming going on in that as well. You know, sort of lurkers who would come into the internet chat because they knew they liked Lolita and what that meant to them, the lurkers, what it signaled to them, which was not necessarily true. But to have conversations about it because people are still reading it, just the way we talk about it. If we don't talk about it as a love story with love story on the cover anymore, if we don't think of Lolita as the sunglasses, right? Sloane Crosley talks about those heart-shaped sunglasses that we all think of as Lolita and like Lolita looking up over them, but that's not in the book. That's not even in the movies. So just sort of, if we can get back to talking about these conversations and the essays you guys have written about what's actually in the book, I think it will help people read it. You know, the issue when it was published in the 50s was censorship. It was obscenity laws. The Viking editor who turned it down thought they would go to jail. Now, you know, then there were these years when I read it in the 90s, it was like high art meets low art. It's Nabokov, right? And now it's, you know, there was nothing to question really. But now we're looking at this really triggering relationship that can upset people. And how can we talk about this book that's here to stay?
Well, and it's sort of what we were talking about at the beginning, which is the distinction between all of the noise around a book and the book itself. And, you know, plenty of things have been ruined by their fan club, right? So when you're looking at, you know, when you're looking at what, you know, what is said about something and the mischaracterizations and the various images that people have in their minds, I feel like what this book does really well is to bring it back to what is the actual substance of the work. And I think a lot of people who think that they know what Lolita is would be very surprised to go back and actually read it themselves and see it again. Have any of you read it again since those first few readings and found something new in it?
I find something new every time. And I continue to read the annotated version. I'm probably on my second. I know that the original annotated version I had fell apart. And I have a second one. I strangely have multiple copies of Lolita. I seem to always be finding them places. But I'll always find something new every time. And I think that's one of the great pleasures of reading it. And sometimes I'm finding it because my own life experience has changed. And sometimes it's just because there's so much there. Sentences, word choices. I think in my last reading, which was to write the essay for this book, I was really struck by how well he uses memory. And that the way memory is deployed in Lolita, feels especially true to how memory really works in humans. I'm always coming back to that moment when he finally knows that it's Quilty and it's Hourglass Lake. And I was like, yes, that's how people think. That's how it goes. You have this weird little detail. So that's for me. It's always something.
Well, and you pointed out, I had missed that was why waterproof is probably a nerve of the novel, right? When Nabokov says at the end that one of the nerves of the novel is waterproof. And I was thinking, why would that watch be? But that's probably why, because it's when he would have found out about Quilty. Yeah, brilliant.
I reread Lolita frequently because, as Nabokov said, rereading is all that counts, right? And so it's not only discovering new things, but as Laura said, one changes and understands. And not only that, but the context is different and the whole, in some ways, the equation for the book is the Me Too movement, right? It's not that, you know, incredible new things were discovered with the Me Too movement, but there's a different light upon many of the works of art that were taken for, you know, on their face value, as it were. And I also had been reading it for whatever reason in the light of displacement and how relevant, how it fits into Nabokov's work at large, because I've been teaching that and writing about that in various ways, how Humbert is this sort of the pathological version of a displaced person, right? His displacement is both being a foreigner, but being living undercover in the world, in the new world, right? Which it could describe experience of many displaced people and immigrants. And so I also teach Nabokov stories, most of which were written when he was in Europe, right, before he came to the United States, and then were rewritten in English after he moved to the United States. And there's just fraught and loaded with a sense of displacement. And so Lolita fits into that, right? For obvious reason, we isolate Lolita from Nabokov's work. It was his biggest success, and it's become this cultural icon, right? But it is so much of it is about being in a place separate from everyone else around him, right? And one of his crimes, or part of his crime, an aspect of his crime, is that he takes Lolita out of her natural environment. He takes her away from home. He displaces her in the most basic way, and she's never at home. And that, you know, famous ending when the children laughing in the valley, and then Lolita's voice had not been there at all. That is, it's sort of the most poignant instance of displacement in his work, probably, and in all of works about displacement that I have read and dealt with.
I've come back to the book in sections. I have not, since writing this essay, read it in its entirety again. But sometimes I go back in to like revise something I, you know, took away, you know, like the first time I read it and then watched the 90s version of the film, I was like, oh, Charlotte died of a natural cause. And then, you know, that's the kind of thing it just comes to mind. I've just been rereading a lot about like the sections with her and Dolores, and their, for whatever reason, I'm really interested in mother-daughter relationships at the moment, and rereading that and reading her letter and then reading that, you know, scene as like possibly as a murder. And so I'll do that kind of thing. Like, I'm constantly thinking about how, oh, I don't know, maybe let me go back and revise how I took him, like I don't know, like I took it at face value sometimes. So I'll go back for little pockets of what I needed.
I think it's interesting, Bindu, that two pieces in the book, Jessica's piece and Jessica Shattuck and Danny Shapiro's, recreated Charlotte Hayes, the mother, you know, as this angry ghost, this ghost that she also, you know, we talk about the silence, the missing voice of Lolita, but she also gets very little of her own voice.
Yeah. And I always thought it was, you know, how she ends up almost, well, she is a mother in the end, that, you know, that ends very tragically. And it's just kind of this like really chilling symmetry that, I don't know, it's very unsettling. You like keep going back.
One of our viewers tonight, Marcy, asks, Jenny, how did you determine the order of the pieces for the anthology? Because it was so perfectly paced.
Thank you. I worked hard on that. And I guess I just tried to think about what pieces would flow into the next. What subject? Victor's piece on horror, Lolita as a horror novel, and what's horrific about it goes into Christina Baker Klein writing about Humbert as Frankenstein. The one interesting thing there is that I had Cheryl Strayed. She writes a piece that is a Dear Sugar letter. She had a advice column called Dear Sugar, and she wrote a Dear Sugar letter from Lolita that gives Dolores her voice back. And it came into me during the lockdown, right as the pandemic started, and it is breathtaking. And I put that near the front. And then an assistant editor at Vintage said, you know, why don't you move that a little later and give everyone a break from Humbert, right? Like give a reprieve. And so I put it in the middle of the book, and I think it works well, because just when you're so, you know, getting tired of that. And then I tried to also, intersperse, there's popular culture pieces in the book, there's the Lolita fashion, there's, you know, the movies. I tried to put those, intermix those with more deep explorations of like what we've been talking about tonight of the novel itself, just for levity. What I was so happy about is that there's not a lot of overlap in the pieces. I mean, I was worried with us all writing about the same book, and that didn't happen at all.
Was there anything that you had hoped to see an essay about it that you didn't see explored?
Well, I guess they're different. I'm still thinking in my head. I think they're all different because reading is so subjective. So everyone takes something away different from Lolita. I wrote a letter to Phoebe Waller-Bridge and asked her to write a scene, the first scene of a movie reimagined. And she was too busy. But I would have loved to have included that. Other than that, I mean, it's 400 pages. I think it covers. I think it covers almost everything for now.
It's comprehensive.
Yeah, I'm so happy with how it came out. It has short stories in it. It has, you know, I think it's a beautiful book, and it can ride the coattails of Lolita, which still sells really well. But I also like it as a book, you know, a work of art itself. I was able to get really talented writers like you guys. I lucked out.
One last question for everyone. Are there works that you feel are on the level of Lolita that are being published in whatever respect that are being published today? And what are those works that you would place in that company?
Say that, as a foreigner who writes in his non-native language, it delights me to no end that the best American novel, at least most prominent American novel of the 20th century, was written by a Russian immigrant. I was talking about displacement earlier, and one of the themes in Nabokov's work is that because Russia's no longer available for him, right, and he was a foreigner everywhere else, language becomes his homeland, and language as actualized in art of fiction, right? And so I have felt that way more than once, and in writing in my own work, and Nabokov opened up that space. He showed a way to counter displacement in language, in a foreign language. What's amazing about Lolita is it's self-evident in many ways. It's the linguistic invention. Of course, Humbert uses it for his nefarious purposes, but Nabokov uses it to carve himself a piece of the world in which he could have some agency.
I had to use my phone to double check my memory, which is horrible. There's a short story in Adam Johnson's Fortune Smiles, which won the National Book Award. And full disclosure, I was a judge that year. And there is a story in that collection, I think it's called Mr. Flowers, I won't get it right, that tells the story of a pedophile who's trying to white knuckle his way through not being a pedophile. And it's so unlike almost anything I've read. I mean, as I said, I was a judge on that committee. It was a pretty easy decision. I don't want to say it was easy. That's not fair to the other four people on the shortlist, but reading something like that, I really felt that this is part of Lolita's legacy, that we have someone coming at this topic from a different, unexpected angle. And I found a lot of Fortune Smiles. That was a book that invited us to be a little uncomfortable in places and to say, is this fiction? Is it auto fiction? What's going on here across the whole? So that's one book that comes to mind for me.
I don't know that I have an answer to this question, to be honest. I've been thinking about it, and I think the category that this book occupies for me is so singular. Nothing comes to mind immediately, but I was thinking about Sarah Weinman's, and I'm forgetting the title, but like the book about Sally Horner.
Lolita.
Yeah. Not that they're like, so I wouldn't put them in the same category, but that's something that I read after reading Lolita that colored it in a new way. So that's what, yeah.
Mine is totally random because it's nothing. I think one pedophile novel is enough for me, but for me, it's so random, but it's The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead. And I think it's because of that breathless way with the language, what Sasha's talking about. And with that book, I kept saying to my husband, like, are you sure there weren't real underground railroads? Like, I knew there weren't, but the way he painted those pictures with the trains running, and you know, I like the language he used recreated that world for me, that I read that book just as breathlessly as I still read Lolita. Nothing to do with pedophiles.
One last, so before we end, I just wanted to ask all of you if you had any final words, anything you'd wanted to talk about that we hadn't gotten to.
Someone asked last night about a new introduction, and like, I think any of you could do a new introduction to Lolita. It would be terrific. We could take any of the essays from this book. I also think maybe Laura should do a new annotation. I'm not really kidding. I think more women behind this, explaining it, taking love story off the cover, could be really helpful.
Well, I'd like to thank everyone for being here with us tonight and for a fantastic discussion. It was wonderful hearing from you all, and I think we all learned a lot. Thank you to our audience as well for being here.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, author Catherine Schweit discusses her recent book, Stop the Killing, How to End the Mass Shooting Crisis. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.